The Path to Authenticity is brought to you by GIA Miami. Founded by world-class mental health experts, GIA provides advanced care for difficult-to-treat conditions, including anxiety, medication-resistant depression, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. Using state-of-the-art methods, GIA can help people recover from conditions when more traditional approaches can't. Dr. Antonello Bonci has assembled an expert team serving international clientele in a modern and resplendent Miami setting. If you or someone you love is suffering from depression, anxiety, OCD, or other mental health concerns, call GIA at 833-713-0828. You can learn more about GIA by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting GIAMiami.com.
Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Albert Flynn De Silver, and this is Path to Authenticity.
If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 174 for May 10th, 2022. Features the first in a two-part conversation with a poet named Albert Flynn De Silver. I've been really looking forward to sharing this conversation. It's one of those that I didn't really know much about the guest before we spoke, and I feel like we really connected. And I look forward to continuing connecting with Albert. So I hope you enjoy it. Here you go. Albert Flynn De Silver. Booked this through someone who helps you, I assume, book interviews and that sort of thing, a publicist of sorts.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's not often that I'm contacted by someone like that with a prospective guest who is actually a really great fit for the podcast.
That's good to hear.
It's not often, but this is a home run here. I'm really excited
to
talk to you.
We'll see, right?
Well, I suppose we will. So my understanding is you're a writer. Mm-hmm. You're a writing coach, instructor, and you incorporate mindfulness practice into your writing approach and your teachings around writing. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes. Okay.
So how do you describe yourself? If you're at a cocktail party and someone asks you what you do, how do you respond to that question?
Well, when I'm on, I say I breathe and I eat and sleep and mountain bike. And no, I am. Yeah, that's kind of it's a funny question, you know. We're sort of conditioned into asking people what they do. Mm-hmm. As if it's the, you know, defining factor of their being. But yeah, so oftentimes I do take a little bit of pride in being a poet and being a writer and a mindfulness instructor and all of that. So yeah, I tell them that and that I most recently, I'm running an online writing school for creative writers, people who want to write books.
And did I see that you've written some memoir as well?
Yes, I did write a memoir about 2012 that came out.
Okay.
Called Beamish Boy. Yeah. And that was about recovery and being saved by poetry.
When you say about recovery, what does that mean to you?
It was basically an addiction memoir. So I was a devout and practicing alcoholic for from age 12 to about age 22. And so overcame that miraculously. And that's the whole story in and of itself, which is in the book. That's what the whole book is kind of about.
Well, I don't want you to do too much of a spoiler, but given where I come from in life, I'm interested in what happened at 22, how you overcame that.
Oh, boy. Well, so I woke up handcuffed to a hospital bed with no idea how I got there, and I was under arrest. And so that was not my first hospitalization for alcohol abuse. And so it was really sort of a literal wake up call. Like, you're not getting a third chance. Like, if you ever do this again, you're going to die. That was sort of the message that was coming from the universe or great spirit or whatever you want to call it. And then I was sent to because I was under arrest, I had to go deal with the legal system in Boulder County in Colorado. And there was a woman, I think she was like the assistant DA or something. And she brought me into her office and basically told me a little bit about her family story and was like, you're not going to make it if you don't get help now. And so I'm sending you to counseling and I really want you to get help. And she just had this really authentic and beautiful, almost scared for me, sensibility, in our conversation. I was like, wow, nobody's ever said that to me. Nobody's ever like kind of offered this level of kind of care and attention and seriousness to my situation before. My parents were too kind of freaked out and, they couldn't admit it because, I mean, especially my mom, because then she would have to confront her own alcoholism. Right. And that wasn't about to happen. So that was really, and I talk about this woman in the book because she basically saved my life.
Well, I got sober at 23.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. And congratulations.
Thank you. And I wasn't chained to a hospital bed, but there was a gurney involved right before a brief incarceration.
Wow.
And Interesting. Yeah. And left on my own recognizance the following day. And fairly quickly was on a plane from Indianapolis to West Palm Beach. And I just, prior to the conversation, told you I just moved to Indiana after living in West Palm Beach. I went to West Palm Beach to get sober and stayed until last month.
Wow.
So I had a life there for 25 plus years and have my life purpose I came to find was to help people. In the beginning, it was pretty clear, overcome addictions, and now it has changed and I still do that. But there are other things, now I have an understanding that it's more about a fractured relationship with oneself. And so I work with, You know, most of the people I work with are suffering from addiction or were suffering from addiction, but it's not always about that. It's relationships or, you know, codependency, mm-hmm. all the stuff that was there before we ever picked up the bottle.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
So, you know, it's nothing happens by mistake, right? We ended up talking to each other and have a lot more in common than I think either of us would have presumed.
Yeah.
So I love it. So that was a long time ago, I take it, that you went through that experience. And
yeah, 31 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, do you live in Colorado?
No. I live in Northern California.
Oh, that's right. But did you grow up there in Colorado? And
no, I grew up in Connecticut.
Okay.
And New York.
Okay.
And slowly made my way west.
So were you in school in Boulder?
I was.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Somehow I kept it together.
So you got through it. What did you study?
I studied photography, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I did not study writing.
So when did the writing come in and how?
Well, that's a story. So we have a minute, right?
Yeah, of course.
Well, so I was studying photography at the San Francisco Art Institute. So after Colorado, I got sober, and then I didn't really know what to do with my life and myself. So I was painting houses for a while, and that was not – I didn't really see a future in that for me. And so I wasn't sure what else to do. So I thought I'd go back to school. And I had taken all these photographs on a semester abroad in Africa. And they weren't bad. They were pretty good photos. And I thought, wow, well, I really like this photo thing. I wonder if I could get into grad school. So I applied to a couple of schools. And the only school that I thought that I really could manage that was in a city would be San Francisco. And, cause I was a nature guy. Like I couldn't imagine living in a city, but if there ever was a city that has like a very direct relationship to nature, it's San Francisco. There's so much open space, like right over the bridge. Mm. And, anyway, so I ended up applying, I got in, and, I did 2 years in a graduate program. And there was one of my mentors was a guy named Bill Berkson, who is an art history teacher at the Art Institute. And he was a poet. And we all had to take his class. So we all had to kind of go through his class in order to graduate. And there was one night that I was bumbling around the photo studios. I was totally kind of lost in grad school. And, I actually almost failed out, which is hard to believe. Like, how do you fail at art? Right. But I managed to come close. And anyways, one night there I was milling about and Bill came by and he said, "Hey, you know, there's this poetry reading happening at the Cal Theater in San Francisco. Do you want to come check it out?" I was like, "Poetry? Not really my thing, but, I don't have anything going on." So, I guess I'll go check it out. So I go to this reading, and it turns out it's the launch reading for the Norton Anthology of Postmodern American Poetry. And it's like this huge deal. And like Diane de Prima is there, and Lynn Hagenian, and Alice Notley has flown in from Paris, and all these amazing writers, none of who I knew at the time. I didn't really know what to expect. But I was totally blown away. And I had never thought of poetry in such a diverse kind of way. And I remember the editor, Paul Hoover, who edited the anthology, he was reading as part of the introduction. He read this quote from Jack Spicer, who's one of these legendary Bay Area poets from the 1950s. He was part of
the Beats?
What they call the, no, he was pre-Beat. So he was Berkeley Renaissance. So it was like late 40s, early 50s. Anyways, he was famous for this poem about kind of had a bunch of photography imagery in it. It's called Imaginary Elegies. And he told this, there was this line in that poem that goes, Unbind the dreamers, poet be like God. And I thought, whoa, it kind of like, you know, blew the hair back in my head. And I was just, what does that even mean? You know, I didn't, but it just sounded so profound and so amazing. Unbind the dreamers. And I was a dreamer, you know, I was in art school and I was dreaming of being an artist and, you know, being able to show my work around. And then there was this line about poet be like God. And I was like, God, what does God, I didn't even know what God meant. You know, I didn't come from a religious household. How I interpreted it was like, be like spirit, you know, be fully engaged, be radiant, be beaming. And, I thought, that's it. Like, that's what I want to be doing. And I started jotting down notes in my notebook that night that would become poems. And that was my first scratching towards poetry. And that was 1994. I think that was. So, yeah. And after that, I mean, I graduated from the Art Institute. I had a few shows. I had a couple shows down in LA. And I had done a show at the Boulder Public Library, my photography. But then I just started going to more and more poetry readings and going to libraries and, you know, buying all these books by poets in the anthology. And then I learned about the California Poets in the Schools, which is a program where they send poets, working poets, into the schools to not teach kids about poetry, but to inspire kids to find their own voice, to find their own sensibilities for the world and expressions for the world through language. And so I started studying with them and being mentored by a poet named Dwayne Big Eagle. And next thing I know, I'm teaching poetry in the schools.
Wow.
So, and I did that for about 12 years.
That's a long time.
It was a long time. Yeah. Especially, you know, as a sort of part-time poet teacher, you know, never making more than like 20 grand a year and trying to scrape by in Northern California. I mean, granted, this was a long time ago, but still.
Do you know of the poet Spencer Reese?
I do not know Spencer Reese.
Yeah. Spencer Reese, he's written a couple books of poetry. One's called The Clerk's Tale, and the other is called The Road to Emmaus.
Huh.
And really very interesting guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the first guests I had on the podcast. He's a guy in long-term recovery, and... Mm-hmm. I actually met him in it was the Bible as Literature, the class.
That's great.
And I took it because I had taken a creative writing workshop the term before by the same instructor, who's another poet named Eddie Vega. And Vega brought – he liked – he didn't like to lecture, so he would show a lot of films, and he'd bring people in, and he brought Spencer in to do a reading, and I was probably sober 5-6 years at the time, and I was listening to him, and I was like, this guy's, you know, this guy's in recovery. And so we became friends, and so, long story short, he worked at Brooks Brothers by day.
Interesting.
Hence The Clerk's Tale. And I remember going to his apartment for the first time. And it was a modest old condo, old South Florida condo, and second floor. And he had framed letters of response that he had gotten from all the literary magazines where he had submitted his poetry. And they were rejections, but some of the editors took time to give him direction or support or whatever. And his walls were covered with these. Mm-hmm. And it really struck me. And long story short, he, for 10 years, kept trying to get his work published over and over and over and over again, sent it everywhere, never gave up. And then finally he got his book published, and then he won a Guggenheim Fellowship.
What? Oh my God, that's great.
and became a Fulbright scholar.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
So it's a really an incredible story of perseverance and someone who I'm sure you'd love to know more about. But
oh, totally. Yeah, that sounds great. And I have a similar story. I mean, I've not yet gotten the Guggenheim.
Right.
Although my neighbor, this is funny, my neighbor is a choreographer and he just got a Guggenheim.
Wow.
And it's just the coolest thing. But anyways, going back to the Spencer Reese, I love that he worked at Brooks Brothers. And what's coming into my head right now is the fact that the only retail establishment that I ever got a handwritten thank you note from was a Brooks Brothers outlet here in Northern California. And I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing, like literally handwritten in the one of the clerks, like goofy little handwritings, just thanking me for stopping by and purchasing something.
Yeah.
And you see this very rarely in retail or any other industry for that matter. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's something that he either did or knew, but I wonder, because being a poet, like, what a great opportunity, right?
Yeah. Well, and it was in Palm Beach, which is a very interesting place, you know?
right.
But, you know, what you're talking about, there's something about men's clothing stores of old, right?
Or a
couple generations before us, the men who were clerks at these places. And, you know, having just moved back to Indiana, I've been making the rounds, like going to different places finding where I'm going to buy clothes, finding where I'm going to get my coffee and all that kind of stuff. And, and I needed a pair of slippers. And I was in a Nordstrom in Indianapolis, and, you know, I tried these on and I got to talking to this guy and he was 75, you know, but just started talking about his life and it was a very nice interaction. And it's, that is conspicuously absent now. And a lot of times when you go to stores, at least in my experience in adult life, a lot of times the clerks don't even make eye contact.
Yeah.
Might say hello. I mean, some experiences are different than others, but you know, it's taking the time to actually make a connection with another human being.
Yeah.
We've lost a lot of that. And I think it's probably worsened exponentially since the advent of social media.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Totally. Well, I think it's up to us to reclaim it. You know, to remind and to step into those authentic interactions, even the most, you know, especially the most sort of mundane and ordinary ones that you would normally probably just brush off, you know. But I remembered now what I was going to say about that, the perseverance piece, which I forgot to say, was that there's a magazine here in Northern California that's kind of a legendary artists and writers magazine. It's called Ziziba. And that I had my, as an early and young writer, I was just like, I need to be published in Ziziba. Like, I will not be able to survive this creative life if I don't get published there. So I just kept sending them work. And, you know, just rejection after rejection, you know, one and then two and then seven and then eight and then 15 and then 26 and then, you know, 43. And then finally, like submission number 52, I finally broke through. Wow. But that's kind of like, that's the artist's journey, right? You know, whether you're a poet or a musician or a dancer or painter, it's just settling into the love of it, the love of the process, and believing in yourself and being just rigorously persevering.
So then, would you say you're a self-taught writer?
I am. Yeah, I mean, I went to a couple of workshops over the years and classes, but mostly, you know, I mean, I taught as a California poet in the schools for 12 years, having just gone to the library and, you know, getting books out of the library, like how to teach poetry.
Right.
Not that there were very many books like that, but I was really winging it at the beginning. You know, I had no idea. I just had a love of the medium. You know, I was so jazzed about it. And I think the kids got that. You know, they could tell.
Yeah.
And so then I just, you know, it became a little more methodical. Once I connected with the poets in the schools program, I actually studied with, you know, I had a mentor and I had to come up with my own curriculum design and I was going to conferences and things like that. But yeah, largely self-taught in terms of just writing.
Well, and that, the comment you made about the kids being able to pick up on your enthusiasm, I always took any journalism class I could take.
Mm-hmm.
And in high school, I took a mass media class that was taught by, you know, this woman in the English department. And it was, I mean, it was a good class. I learned some stuff. It was a little ho-hum. It was very much an introductory sort of thing. And she was okay. A few years later, I had her for American Lit.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different experience. She loved it so much.
Yeah.
That she made me love it, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's when I really started to explore poetry, you know, reading Whitman and also Twain. She really turned me on to Mark Twain, who is one of my favorites. And it really does make a difference. If you love it, that comes through.
It does indeed. Yeah.
So, and you know, one of the ways, going back to this Eddie Vega guy, I'll never forget the way he defined poetry, and I love it. He calls it condensed language.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I never really understood it until then. But it really is. Like that sentence or two that you mentioned that escapes my memory already.
Oh, yeah. Unbind the dreamer's poetry like God. Yeah.
I mean, if you think about everything that says, we could talk about that for an hour.
Oh, right. Yeah. Or Carl Sandburg's famous definition, which is poetry is an echo asking a shadow to dance.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's like, what? How's that? What does that even mean?
How's that for poetic imagery?
Yeah. Wow. Right. And there's so many kind of ideas and imaginative notions that ripple forth from that.
Mm-hmm. Are you a music guy too?
I love music. Yeah. listen to a lot of different kinds of music.
Are you familiar with Jason Isbell?
Oh yeah, sure.
He's a poet.
Indeed. Yeah. I haven't listened to enough of him and really read the lyrics. This is a good reminding.
Really powerful stuff. It is. I have kind of nerded out on him over the last few years. Uh-huh. I've seen him live a couple times. He's fantastic live. Uh-huh. And I mean, I like his voice. I like the music, but I really, most of the time with music, I'm a lyrics guy.
Oh, fun.
And, you know, there are a lot of great songwriters. Not all of them I would describe the way I would him as a poet. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, his rhymes are layered. You know, there's so many. He knows how to write. That's right. What it is. You know, the
well,
verbs
you know,
he
the
chooses.
Texans. I'm a big fan of the Texans, like you know, Robert Earl Keen and Towns Van Zandt, mm-hmm. And that whole crew that sort of came of age in the 70s and mm-hmm. early 80s. Really good writers, really good storytellers. And, you know, Towns Van Zandt always used to say that a song had to work as a poem first. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so he's one of my all-time heroes in the songwriting world. And he's been covered probably more than any other songwriter from Texas that I can think of, besides like Dylan, maybe.
Yeah, I have Our Mother the Mountain, and mm-hmm. I have, I think the other one is just called Towns Van Zandt. I have a couple of his records, and
that's great.
Yeah, that
and Lucinda. Lucinda Williams.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely love Lucinda. And, you know, her dad was a poet.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And he taught, I think, at LSU or one of those great Southern colleges. Hmm. And so she, you know, she grew up steeped in poetry. And you can tell, right? Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. It's like, oh, yeah.
Well, and, you know, Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature a few years ago.
Yeah.
Which I loved. And, you know, if Visions of Johanna is not a poem, I don't know what it's.
Such a great song. It is, it's one of my all-time faves.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's, it doesn't really matter. I don't think the genre of writing, mm-hmm. the principles of it apply pretty much wherever you go with it.
Well, I always tell my students that poetry is the ground of all great writing. The ground of all great writing. Yeah. So like whether you're writing a play or an opera or a novel, like, you know, you think about the highest compliment a critic can give you in any writing genres that, you know, your work is poetic.
Hmm.
And, you know, I take that literally in the writing sense, of course, but that also can be referenced in, you know, any even athletic pursuits and other art forms for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, well, it's, grace
mm-hmm.
comes to mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a mystical aspect of it. It's just transcendent.
Right.
If you can really achieve that. And, you know, like I would say, Ken Griffey Jr.'s Swing. If you've seen that, mm-hmm. I mean, that is perfection. That is yeah. poetry. You know,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's singular. Yeah. All right. There you go. Another episode in the books. Thanks for listening. You can learn more about the show and this episode's guest at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you enjoy this episode, please share it with someone. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every little bit helps. I want to thank the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. If you're so inclined, check out the Patreon community. As soon as I do these interviews, I upload them to Patreon, where the content is only available to patrons and for just a couple bucks a month. I usually post audio content there, exclusive audio content, probably 8 times a month, if not more. And as these new episodes are released, as soon as they're done, they're available to patrons. So sometimes that might be 2 weeks before an episode is released, or even longer. Usually it's a few days. Anyway, if you want to support the show, that's a great way to do it. So thanks again for investing your time. It's a big deal to me. Thank you for supporting me and supporting the show. I hope you keep coming back. Be nice.
That's our story. I hope you enjoyed the Punk Rock Opera. We have one last piece of music for you. It goes like this.
Just the losers and the generation, self-made bands. We cut our teeth with bloody hands. The rage that's instilled in us can feed a crowd.
Thank you, and good night.